Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X-Word Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm your host, Brooks Adams.
Life expands consciousness.
This is where the past meets the future.
Despite vital to space travel.
In here, the results are always positive. Whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you're about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become that you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. There are no sunspots facing Earth today. The backside of the sun is kicking it out. The solar wind is 377.9 kilometers per second, and the proton count is up to 2.9. Just a few days ago, a CME hit Earth's magnetic field, sparking shamrock green auroras on St. Patty's Day around the Arctic Circle. Photographers wore their cameras out, staying up all night to record the display. A bright meteor briefly outshined the lights of New York City just a couple of days ago on Friday, according to reports by witnesses who use Twitter and the internet to report sightings of a fireball streaking over a broad stretch of the U.S. East Coast. First fireball sightings came in about 8 p.m. Eastern Time, more than 500 witness reports to the American Meteor Society. Reports of the meteor flooded Twitter from New York, Boston, and Washington, D.C. could be seen as far south as North Carolina. A lot of people don't know this, but Earth is bombarded by nearly 100 tons of material from space every day. But most of those objects are tiny dust grains that burn up harmlessly in the atmosphere. They come during the day, so you can't see them. NASA scientists and astronomers around the world regularly monitor the night sky for signs of larger asteroids that pose an impact threat to Earth. Friday night's meteor came just days after back-to-back hearings in the House and Senate about the dangers posed by near-Earth asteroids. Great timing. They must be listening to X-Squared Radio because we report on this weekly. And they must have read the books from the Ark of Millions of Years series because they would have learned that we're in the galactic plane now that it's 2013. And this is a gravel road of space. This is where a lot of rocks and boulders exist that we have never seen before, or at least not for about 25,000 years. Kind of a rocky neighborhood, but we like it. Hey, if you want to join the program tonight, and I encourage you to do so, all you have to do is call the following numbers. Anywhere in North America, toll free, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537, 530-413-9537. We also, for your convenience, have set up a conference line. Those of you that are X Squared Radio regulars know about this, but if you want to listen using your cell phone and get out of town and bob around, you can call 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769-608-pound. Of course, you could put this on speed dial so that all you have to do is hit the number, and it will dial it automatically, including the passcode. Or you could go to X Squared Radio and download the Android app, which is on the left-hand side of the screen. You can see it there as the X Squared Radio logo. Just click on that, download it to your phone, and you're only one touch away from X Squared Radio Live. Our archives are located at two locations. One is x2-radio.com. On the right-hand side of the upper menu, you'll see the link for archives. $20 a year, which is less than the price of a cup of coffee per month, and you have access to thousands and thousands of hours of X Squared Radio archives. Or you can go to the left side of the screen and click on the BBS Radio archive link, and you can listen to every one of the BBS Radio hosts at bbsradio.com. Easy to do either way. Lots and lots of great content to listen to. Now, tonight we have a ton of news for you. And we have several updates. We have a Wars R Us update. We have a drone update. And we're now following this banking debacle, which we broke to you last Sunday before any of this came down on Monday of last week. And that was the bank takeover and massive attempted bank robbery in Cyprus. We have a lot more detail than you're hearing in the news now. You think one thing, but by the time we're done tonight, you're going to know what's going on. And the Wars R Us update is quite lengthy, too, because we have a lot of players. We have a lot of saber-rattling. In fact, we have trash can lids and everything else being banged together all over the world. North Korea warned of strong military counteraction if the United States again flies B-52 bombers over the Korean Peninsula, with two flights this month after the totalitarian regime threatened preemptive nuclear strikes. Yeah, it's a difficult thing to do these days. You don't just hit the national news and say you're going to make a preemptive nuclear strike against the United States and not expect some kind of, you know, warrior visit. And I can tell you, not from personal experience, except that I used to work at the, when I was in the Air Force, at the B-52 base where we ran those sorties. There is no more feared sound on the planet than that of B-52 flying overhead. The U.S. Pacific Air Force's command successfully carried out the latest training flight, they're calling it, the 7th Air Force. Spokeswoman Major Rochelle Dowdell said in an email this week without giving further details. A B-52, by the way, can carry nuclear warheads and air-to-ground missiles with a range of 3,000 kilometers. That's about, 1,800 miles. We fly over there on a regular basis, but lately we've been flying over very, very close so that they could grab the binoculars and look up and see, and if they listen closely, they could hear. That's not a good feeling that any time we wanted, we could just open the bomb bay door and reach out and touch someone. North Korean leader Kim Jong has been very provocative lately, let's say. The U.S. is increasing its defenses capability in the region after he threatened to use atomic weapons in response to tougher United Nations sanctions. I guess we're beginning to squeeze down on the rice lines there. Yesterday's sortie is actually an air mission that is flown from takeoff to landing. We call it a sortie. Is an unpardonable provocation, introducing a mechanism to deliver a strategic nuclear strike to the Korean Peninsula at a time when its situation is inching close to the brink of war. An unidentified North Korean foreign ministry spokesman said today in a statement carried by the official Korean Central News Agency. I could tell you from my friends that have served in Korea at the numerous bases that we have operating there, this is a war with a small W. The biggest worry that we have is that the regime, which is quite technically capable, by the way, would deliver a weapon to someone with a bigger axe to grind than North Korea, and substantially closer to any of our real assets, ones that could take us by surprise. We call that terror. I guess in real life it's kind of a rogue act of cowardice. But that's what we're facing right now. And it's not alone. We have China being threatened by the U.S. For a nuclear strike on its 3,000 miles of tunnels. We played that audio for you last week. We also have Russia making public statements that they are threatening the United States with a preemptive strike because of the missile shields that we're putting up. We got that audio for you last week. And then we have Korea. And then, of course, we always have the imminent ghost cowardice threat from terrorists around the world. So what we are hearing now is talk that, well, I haven't heard since I was a little boy when we used to get our nuclear attack drills, you know, stop, drop, and roll under the table. Cover your eyes so you don't look at the flash of light. I can tell you people from briefings that I've been in when I was young, you might as well stand up at the window and watch the flash of light and enjoy the show, because dropping and rolling behind a brick wall a couple of miles away from the flash is not going to help you one bit. The first B-52 flight over Korea came on March 8th, which is not very long ago, about 16 days, as part of a U.S. joint South Korea military drill. Defense Department spokesman George Little said in a March 18th statement, he said such flights are routine. The bomber was flown out of Anderson Air Force Base in Guam in the first week of the annual two-month Full Eagle exercise, which ends April 30th. We are drawing attention to the fact that we have extended deterrence capabilities that we believe are important to demonstrate in the wake of recent North Korean rhetoric, Little said. We are in the midst right now of sending a very strong signal that we have a firm commitment to the alliance with our Republic of Korea allies. This, of course, doesn't make China very comfortable, since we're just talking about a peninsula here, not an island. And Kim Jong is kind of a provocative, hot-headed young man that doesn't know too much about the diplomacy of international cooperation. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, who has just recently been sworn into office, said March 15th he will shift $1 billion from a European missile shield to install 14 additional missile interceptors in Alaska against threats by Iran and North Korea. Russia has dismissed the move, muffling hopes of arms control advocates that the U.S. and Russia could improve relations and revive talks on reducing their nuclear arsenals. As you know, a missile defense shield in Alaska is also provocative against Russia. Let me shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about something that happened in 2009, and it is just now really beginning to hit home with the American people, and that was the distribution of a grant, loan, and low-interest loan guarantee money that was originally advertised to help out the green energy industry. As you know, here at X Squared Radio, we're very strong supporters of the Breakthrough Energy movement. If you want to visit them, their link is at X2Radio, x2-radio.com. The Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference is coming up this October. Just about every notable green energy inventor that can make his way to Boulder, Colorado is going to be there. I think you should be there too, even if you have to fly there. Because the energy devices that are going to be displayed can be used in your home, your car. If you want to go off-grid, if you want to make sure that you've got some way to survive at your house with energy besides rubbing two sticks together to make fire, which I'm sure people in your local neighborhood would be rather upset about, Then you need to be there. You need to see what's going on there. There'll be electric vehicles there. There'll be generators there. There'll be energy storage devices, energy conservation devices. And I would venture to say that none of these are on the market yet. Yeah, that's how new they are. Well, while the Green Energy Garden Party was announced to the world by the Washington elites, the smell of cake and free beer became irresistible. There were promises of grants, loans, guarantees, and enormous government contracts in the flyers that were dropped from green airplanes onto the petroleum-powered people below. Like a circus train puffing its way through the suburbs to the big top in the city center, it drew the people's attention away from their dusty plant floors and rotting work uniforms. From publicly traded startups to sweating behemoths, they elbowed their way to the bleachers. Everyone came, because to be seen was to have a chance at winning the prize. The president put on his circus hat and coat in August of 2009 and handed out $384 million in grants while holding the megaphone and pointing to this ring and that. The people cheered each time a winning ticket was announced, but as the list was announced one by one, the cheering began to subside. The crowd began to murmur, "What's going on here?" and began to lower their heads and say, "It's just the president's friends. All the money is going to his campaign supporters." As the band played and the rattle of fresh popcorn fell away to the sound of the president's motorcade heading off to the castle, the people shuffled back to their empty plants and televisions to numb the ignominy of unemployment. The grant money disappeared into the massive budgets of multinational corporate giants, like weekly lottery revenues into the state general fund. $6 trillion later, the government has scavenged every loose dollar in the economy. The plants are still empty. The banks shut down all loan programs except to loan money to the federal government. And they invest all their deposits into money markets each night to earn profits on the tiny margins between currencies. The wealthy have done their best to liquidate their holdings and pack up their cash for safer places abroad. And now, Europe plays the "I didn't do it" blame game on the Cyprus bank. To listen to the German and French governments, the European Central Bank, and European Commission, no one was responsible for the Cypriot deposit tax that was unanimously endorsed in the early hours of March 16th, just before this show last week, and fell apart the day before yesterday. The Cypriot demonstrators shouted slogans as they marched toward the parliament in the capital, Nicosia, during a protest against an EU bailout deal on the 19th of this month. Cypriot demonstrators were not happy. The people were lining up at cash machines and painting "no" on the palms of their hands to protest the levy that, even with a tax-free allowance built in for the smallest savers, and by the way, smallest savers are people that had less than $25,000 in the bank, it didn't win a single yes vote in the Cypriot parliament. Not one. The Cypriot people were lining up at cash machines all over the country trying to get their money out of the bank. The Cypriot fiasco has the hallmark of a classic whodunit. Sony Kapoor, head of the redefined think tank, said in an email note, "Someone somewhere took a decision that now no one nowhere appears to have made." Somebody in Europe made a unanimous decision to go after the Russian mob's money in the Cypriot bank. But, In order to get to their money, they had to go through the depositors' money. Francis Pierre Moscovici said he had wanted an exemption for accounts worth less than 100,000 euros, which is about $129,000. Austria's Maria Fechter said ECB demands made that impossible. Oh, they had to go to almost every depositor. The central bank, Fechter said on Monday, wanted to lowball the tax on larger depositors, magnifying the hit on the smaller ones. Jorge Asmussen, in the ECB executive board member who took part in the finance chief's all-night Brussels meeting, pleaded not guilty, saying the central bank didn't insist on this specific structure of the levy. Other non-authors on the tax on sub-100,000-euro accounts include Spanish economy minister Luis de Guindos, Finnish finance minister Jutta Urpilainen, and the Brussels-based commission, who said today it wasn't comfortable with the package in all its elements, and added that decisions are taken by the member states. Luxembourg's finance minister, Luc Frieden, pointed at everyone, saying in a March 18th interview that it was a very difficult compromise backed by an all-Eurozone member state commission, ECB, and International Monetary Fund. Now the truth comes out. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF. Now we get to the fulcrum. A reconstruction based on interviews with European officials suggests the chain of causality went like this. First Germany, because after all, they're the headwaters of all the money in the euro system, and the IMF. The IMF demanded a full bail-in of Cypriot bank creditors and depositors. Then, to counter this nuclear option, the Commission, with ECB backing, came up with a levy idea. Then the Cypriots, fearful of scaring away big, well, mostly Russian bank clients, spread the tax between the two classes of depositors. Nobody was happy. Cyprus was just hours away from a deal on Friday to raise billions of euros and unlock a bailout from the European Union that could avert financial meltdown and exit from the euro, its ruling party said. The remarks from the deputy leader came after Moscow had rebuffed requests from Nicosia for assistance to save Cypriot banks in which Russians have billions of euros at risk. He gave little detail beyond saying Cyprus was close to a compromise that would let Parliament reverse its rejection of a rescue package offered by Eurozone partners a week ago under the holders of bank deposits would suffer losses. There's a cautious optimism that in the next few hours we may be able to reach an agreed platform so Parliament can approve these specific measures, which will be consistent with the approach, the framework, and the targets agreed at the last Eurogroup meeting. Germany warned Cyprus it was playing with fire, but also kept up pressure by saying the Eurozone was well able to contain any crisis, sticking to a threat to cut Cyprus off. That did not go well with Cypriots, who have some kind of animosity against Germany, which is the economic powerhouse of the euro. Cyprus is not a great producer, but it's kind of like the Grand Caymans of Europe. In other words, it's a great place to deposit your money. Very low taxes, anonymity guaranteed, and the Cypriot people, the Cyprus residents, are very friendly. And for thousands of years, it has been a haven for Southern Europe and Central Europe vacationers. Shares in Piraeus Bank in Athens shot up 20% before officials confirmed Piraeus would take control of the Greek units of Bank of Cyprus and Cyprus Popular Bank, two big retail lenders badly burned by exposure to Greece's own troubles. Eurozone leaders, led by Germany, have offered Cyprus 10 billion euros on condition it raises 5.8 billion of its own. How do they raise that money? Well, you guessed it. They just take it from their depositors.
EU officials criticized Cyprus for insisting on taxing even small savers whose deposits up to 100,000 euros benefit from a state guarantee, a measure Cypriot leaders favored in order to limit the losses for bigger depositors. It's very similar in the United States. Your money is guaranteed, I believe, up to $250,000 by the FDIC. However, let me qualify that right after I take a sip of my lovely grapefruit juice. Hold on. There are conditions to the FDIC. There are two of them, main ones. Number one, if your account is involved in a money market is sometimes when you go to the bank, you don't like paying those monthly fees, do you? And so in order to not pay those monthly fees, you decide to allow your funds to be used in a money market. That means that when the bank closes at 5 p.m., your money is dumped into a pool of funds that are managed by the bank. The bank uses a computer program to buy other currencies, yen, yuan, euros, back and forth around different currencies. There, as you know, from time to time during the day are differences between those currencies. It's called the currency exchange. Well, many times during the month, let's say 20 to 25 times during the month, those trades are made. Now, they don't make much money on a trade, perhaps a tenth of a percent here, maybe 0.2% there. But by the time you total it up, it's about 10 to 12% per month. Now, if you calculate that on an annual basis, it's called annualization. We're not talking about 10 or 12%. We're talking about 130 to 150% interest. That's correct. That's what the bank makes on your money by doing these trades. However, because you opt to have a free checking account or a free banking account without having to maintain a minimum balance, you forfeit the right to be covered by the FDIC. Yes, that's right. So if you have $70,000 or $50,000 or $20,000 in your savings account or your checking account, let's say you're using it for payroll, let's say you're using it for a cash flow account for your small business, maybe you run a small business out of your home or an internet business of some kind, none of that money is protected by the FDIC. That means that if the bank should happen to be asked to do what the Cyprus bank is being asked to do, and that is to sort of pitch in to the bailout, okay? You come up with part of the money, we'll come up with the bulk of the money, and with that we'll bail the bank out. Guess what? Your funds are available for use, just like the small depositors in the Bank of Cyprus. Now, the Bank of Cyprus urged the government to go back and make a deal with the EU under which larger deposits over 100,000 euros would be taxed. It was preferable, it is said, to a collapse of the system and a return to the Cypriot pound, which would wipe out assets, let me tell you. And the bank said there must be no further delay. Okay, the bank's been closed for a week. It's been on holiday for a week. People have been interviewed repeatedly this last week, driving all over Cyprus, hitting tellers, trying to get their cash out of the bank so they could pay their bills, buy groceries, pay their babysitters, buy fuel, you know, the normal basics. And none of those tellers is working. EU leaders, notably Germans, who faced an election in 6 months, have been reluctant to give up on the bank levy since it protects them from accusations of using European taxpayers' money to bail out big Russian investors in Cyprus. Everyone knows now, we didn't know before, but everyone knows now that the Russian mob and many of the illegal businesses that run large import-export businesses in Russia deposit the bulk of their cash in Cyprus banks. Because in Cyprus, you don't pay the taxes on those reserve cash accounts like you do in Russia. Well, the International Monetary Fund wants access to that money. And in order to get to it, as I said, they have to go through the regular Cyprus depositors. Now, obviously, the bulk of the depositors have less than 100,000 euros into Cyprus Bank, just like I imagine the listeners to X Squared Radio don't have $189,000 in savings in the bank. Some do, but not very many. And most voters, even here in the United States, would say, well, you want to take money from people that have over $250,000 in the bank? Well, hey, have at it. They're the rich. They have it. We don't. Leave our money alone. But they needed more than what they could get from the rich. And not only that, but the rich are very powerful. And the rich wish to remain unnamed. And the rich wish to remain rich. And it's a big no-no for the government to go in and just take money from the rich. Because small people can't do much about it. They can't hire attorneys. They also can't hire big guys with big sticks. Also in the news, I'll stick this right here in the middle. French police raided the personal home of the head of the IMF. Let's connect the dots, people. The press says that they were looking for evidence that she was dealing preferentially with some of her friends by giving them easy loans of €500,000. But let's be realistic. The French police got a phone call from somebody. You get over to that IMF manager's home and you find me what I need to stop this. She is not going to take my money out of the Cyprus bank. You know, and I know, that's probably what went down. While this had raised concern that it might erode confidence in banks in other bigger Eurozone states, notably Spain and Italy, the leaders of the Eurozone have made clear they believe they can contain any damage, even if Cyprus is forced into a bankruptcy that would lead it to abandoning the euro. Well, it goes much beyond this because, as I said last week, this is a type and a shadow, my friends, a type and a shadow. The International Monetary Fund not only operates in Europe, it also operates in other areas, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, South America, Mexico, and yes, the United States. If we have a type and a shadow, a precedent that is set where the major bankers can go in and just seize cash, close the bank and seize cash, not theirs, not the bank's, but the depositors' money. Now, you see the potential. They're playing with fire. Everything is subject to the approval of Cyprus's lenders at the EU, ECB, and International Monetary Fund. The head of the Euro Group of Eurozone ministers, Dutchman Joren Dijsselbloem, said it was focused on keeping Cyprus in the Eurozone. Asked whether Cyprus's exit from the Eurozone was inevitable, he did not rule it out. However, he says, all kinds of scenarios are possible, and the scenarios we're focusing on are to come to a joint solution in which Cyprus is saved, but in which the banking sector continues in a smaller but healthier form. Germany had rejected a proposal to nationalize pension funds and demanded Cyprus take an axe to its bank. Now, I know this is just one quick sentence, and it's difficult to understand the severity, the importance, the ramifications of it. But let me open this up for you. Nationalizing pension funds is exactly what we talked about on this program in January and February of this year. Early this year, the head of Health and Human Services and also the head of finance was interviewed. And she was asked directly, do you plan to confiscate the 401k accounts and Roth IRA accounts of the depositors of the United States of America, issue them a IOU and pull them into the Social Security system? She said, absolutely not. People, that means absolutely she is planning on doing that. That's why we have asked you, we have advised you, and this is not professional advice. It's what I did. It's what a lot of listeners to this program have done. They have very carefully, very quietly gone and liquidated their 401k accounts, their Roth IRA accounts, taken everything out of mutual funds, which are managed by fund managers, liquidated everything into cash, and then they have moved that cash into safer places. Now, I'm not saying telling you what to do, but some of those places were the mattress at home. Some of those places were credit unions. I had a very nice email from a listener who said she had moved her money into a credit union. Now, I must tell you, from my viewpoint, and this is my personal opinion, credit unions are owned by the members of that union. They're not into the regular banking system. They don't take risks like regular banks. They more carefully meet the credit needs of their own community, that is to say, the members of the credit union. So when it comes to the prime bank being able to reach into credit unions and seize deposits like this, it's going to be second or third tier seizures. So you're probably pretty safe in a credit union. But I also have to tell you that the actual paper itself, that is to say, the dollar, the paper dollar bill, even if you were to take the cash out of the bank, bind it in rubber bands, and put it into plastic tubs under your bed, the paper itself is losing value every minute of the day. The Fed is printing money as fast as the presses will run, to the tune of $40 to $80 billion a month. They're doing this to shore up the dollar, to create some kind of false value. Oh, it's false, too. Let me tell you, there's nothing but ones and zeros back in this money, which means they're stealing the money right out of your bank accounts the same way the European Bank and the IMF is trying to steal money out of the Cyprus banks. Only they're really trying to take the cash. What our Fed is doing is they're simply printing money, which is robbing your buying power. You feel it every time you go to the grocery, every time you buy a gallon of gas or school clothes or a home or a car. You feel it because your dollars don't buy what they did 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 5 years ago. So what do you do? How do you protect the value that you have built, that you have put together? Do you leave it in the bank after the stories and the reports that we've given you here? Do you cash out and put the cash under your bed? Or do you turn it into something that will hold value? That's a good question. You can turn it into land. You can turn it into cars. Titled automobiles are a good commodity. You can turn it into gold and silver. That I highly recommend. Normally, in a normal portfolio, you'd move 10 to 15% of your money to hedge losses in the value of the currency into metal. Most investors do this in the form of bullion. This is a tradable commodity on the market. Most small investors don't trust bullion these days. They want to hold the metal in their hands, and I commend you for that. I don't care if it's a silver dollar. By the way, the silver eagle is 31.1 grams of pure silver mixed with copper. So you have about 3.9 grams of copper and about 31.1 grams of silver. So it's not pure silver, but you do have 1 ounce of silver in a silver eagle. The copper is just added for durability of the coin because it's legal tender. There are some states, most recently Arizona, Nevada, and Utah has a very creative program. Utah has a gold and silver depository. You can take your silver, deposit it, and they will issue you a debit card. You can use the debit card based upon the value of the silver and gold which you have in your account. However, there's a restriction, at least in Utah. The only thing they accept is legal tender minted by the U.S. Mint. That means silver eagles and gold $20 pieces. or $20 gold pieces. That's all they accept. They don't accept silver bars. They don't accept Krugerrands or other things like that. Now, some of the states are going to change away from that. They're going to accept other forms of gold and silver. Right now, I believe there are four states, and there's a fifth that's thinking about opening it. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but this is a real thumb in the eye to the U.S. Treasury. It's telling the U.S. Treasury that individual states are declaring their sovereignty by saying, we are going to control our own currency, and we're going to use gold and silver as a back to value in our state, not the U.S. dollar. Well, as you know, last year in Phnom Penh in Vietnam, those of you that are my age remember those words, but now Vietnam is a very strong player in the world of manufacturing and world trade. Well, last year, there was a financial summit. The Asian community, which makes up about 50% of the world's population, had a meeting. At this meeting, they discussed monetary policy, just like they do at the G20 and the G8. President Obama flew over there and attended. Of course, unofficially, what has been reported is that President Obama was asked to go home, that he was not welcome there. Why wasn't he welcome there? Because the United States was not playing in their game. They told him they're moving on without the dollar. That means that the United States is not involved any longer in the world economy. They're going to move on without us. Did you hear that report in the news? No, you did not. So if the world, 50% of the world's population is going to move forward without the dollar, what do you think is going to happen to you? Exactly. This is why this is so important. This is why the sovereignty of Cyprus should be paramount with what you're watching in the news. Cyprus people have rejected the bailout deal, leaving the Eurozone facing a fresh crisis. If Cyprus drops out of the Eurozone, all of the capital that is tied up there, all of the raw capital, the deposits from the Russians and others, falls outside the Eurozone, which means the Eurozone has to support itself without that money. Cyprus, Greece, Italy, and Spain, those economies are going to tie together. Now, you've already seen a wealthy flight from Spain. You've seen the depositors leave there by the hundreds. Spain has done their very best to try to contain the flight, try to keep money from moving out. France has done the same thing. You've seen some very public figures leaving France with their money. Italy is right on the cusp, and it is a much, much larger economy than Greece. Greece, we've seen because the Greeks, a heavily welfare state, were turning over cars, burning hay bales in the streets because they were upset that their welfare paychecks were going to be cut off. Nevertheless, austerity, which is basically a little like parents cutting down on their kids' allowance, is helping. It is beginning to have its effect. The cash-strapped nation of Cyprus expected to seek funding lifeline from Russia after a dramatic no vote in the country's parliament. And, of course, so far, peaceful demonstrations in the streets. The Cypriot parliament has thrown out the controversial plan to skim, and I use that word very liberally, skim from the savers' bank accounts in a move that risks plunging the Eurozone into a fresh crisis. It also heightens expectations that the cash-strapped country will seek a funding lifeline from Russia. And you know, that just injects Russia's economic power more into the European community, not the Eurozone, but the European community than anybody wants. And I'm afraid the United States is kind of out to lunch because we're not being a very good example, my friends. We are printing money as fast as the ink can dry. There's 56 members in the Cypriot parliament, and they rejected the bank tax by 36 votes with 19 abstentions. Not one person voted for it, even after the proposal had been tweaked during the day to remove any levy on savings below 20,000 euros. That's a really, I'm going to say, average deposit account. In return for the levy, savers would be given shares in Cyprus's banks and possibly a share in the nation's gas reserves once the country is back on its feet. I'm sure that that holds a lot of value with the citizens of Cyprus. Mario Mavrides, a government MP and former finance minister, raised the prospect of the country becoming the first to leave the euro. He told BBC Two's Newsnight, "If we cannot come up with the 5.5 billion euros in a few days, then I think we will go to the Cyprus pound. That will be the end of Cyprus in the eurozone. We're going to exhaust all other possibilities, but what can we do? If we have no other solution, we cannot leave the people without money." Despite what is now seen as a botched decision to try to confiscate the funds of savers with less than 100,000 euros, Joran Dijsselbloem, the Dutch finance minister and chair of the Eurogroup, issued a terse statement demanding that the Cypriot pledge at the weekend be honored. Germany sought to contain any damage from the Cypriot debacle. They said, "We've taken adequate precautions to ensure that today's decision in Cyprus will have no negative effect on the rest of the eurozone." By the way, that was Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister. There were calls for another emergency meeting of eurozone finance ministers as the dangerous brinkmanship between Nicosia and the rest of Europe escalated before the vote. Hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside the Nicosia parliament chanting "no," and it was probably more like thousands. Officials in Brussels insisted Cyprus savings tax will be a one-off, and the guarantee stands across the rest of the EU. Yeah, we've heard that before. This is only temporary. We're only going to put this in temporarily. Not to worry. Everything's, you know, faith and credit. Faith and credit of the United States. You know, God bless America. Da, 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 da. And the next thing you know, the measures have been in place for 20 years and growing. The conservative ruling party aligned to Anastasiades had attempted to postpone the bill to another day, but opposition MPs insisted on a vote. The 19 members of the president's party abstained, even though the government had signed up on Saturday's bailout to release 10 billion euros of the eurozone funds and raised 7 billion through a combination of bank levy and new austerity measures, cutbacks in spending, you know. Russia had expressed its anger about the levy, which would hit its nationals, its wealthy, that have a lot of money deposited there. And I'm sure we're ringing the red phone all night long. Vladimir Chizhov, Russia's envoy to the EU, likened the levy to a forceful expropriation that could wreck Cyprus's financial system. When the banks open, people will rush to withdraw their deposits. That's also another threat. And then the whole banking system can collapse. We are affectionately calling this across the world the Cyprus jog. The Cyprus jog, which many fear is going to turn into the Cypriot sprint. That means that as soon as the bank doors open, they will be ripped off the hinges as people elbow their way to the teller counter to say, "I'm closing my account, give me all my cash." Like that would happen here in the United States. Well, I don't know if you've been listening to this program very long, but in the last 12 months, more than 355 banks have closed in the United States. The FDIC has very carefully, very quietly been trying to contain it. But I was telling you there were two parts to the FDIC earlier. One, was that if your account is involved in a money market, be very careful about the small print, then you are not insured by the FDIC. And the second point is that if that bank were to close and you had less than $250,000 in the bank, which would be covered under the FDIC under very narrow parameters, the bank has up to 10 years to return your money to you. Oh, and by the way, you don't receive the interest. You only receive the principal. Excuse me, 10 years to return the principal to you. What do you think that principal will be worth in 10 years? What do you think that principal will be worth in 10 months as fast as they're printing money? Well, the Cyprus banks are going to remain closed until further notice. About 4 weeks ago, I wrote a short paper called Happy Holidays, Fun and Profit in the Coming Bank Collapse. I also read a paper, a supporting paper, by a world-renowned, brilliant economic strategist, David Martin. His website is Inverted Alchemist, if you want to check it out. An excellent blog. I highly recommend that you read it on a regular basis. Now, if you read David's stuff, you might have to have a dictionary with you, because he is one very, very fine writer and an excellent speaker. If you ever have a chance to hear David Martin, you go listen to him. You won't regret it. In those two papers combined, what we painted was a very real picture that banks have taken liberties with your money, because banks don't really have money of their own. Shareholders of the banks earn money off the profits they make by gambling or investing with your money. And if those investments go badly and they lose, which, as you know, the banks had to have a massive bailout because they gambled with your money on mortgages. Because, as you know, House Democrats forced legislation into place, forcing banks to loan money to people that had no business borrowing money to buy homes. Those mortgages were underwritten and were put into loan packages. And then when you take out a home loan, it's normally a 30-year mortgage. Well, let's just say, to make the math easy, you're going to borrow $100,000 to buy a home. It's a 30-year mortgage. By the time you calculate the total interest that you're going to pay back, you're paying $300,000 for the home. Well, that $200,000 difference spread over the 30 years is value that has not been received yet, but it will be one day by the bank. And so what they do is they sell off that future value. It's called a derivative. You've heard of this term in the news. That's what it is. They pool these derivatives together, and then the bank sells them off, or they borrow money against them, and they use that money to gamble on the money market and to buy other assets. Believe me, it is so profitable, so massively profitable, that you can go into every city, every town, every tiny hamlet in the entire United States, and the two finest, newest buildings in town will be the bank and the church. Well, neither one actually generates money of their own, but at least we give to the church voluntarily. The bank uses your money to make money. You don't go to the bank and donate money to them, but the bank uses your money to make money, and that's how it grows. That's how it grows. So now you know how the banking system works. And the important part to note here is that when the bank takes risks and the bank loses, then it's the taxpayers that have been bailing it out. That's you, again. So instead of dipping into your bank account and saving the bank, they just dip into your paycheck and save the bank. That's how it's done. So when we talk about a bank holiday, we're not talking about Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We're not talking about Good Friday coming up this week. We're not talking about those legal holidays that the bank closes. We're talking about when the bank closes to say, you know what, we need some time to breathe here. We need to use your money for a little while without you coming in and doing something stupid like taking your money and going to the grocery with it. So we're going to close for a while until we can make some of this money back, and then we'll reopen the bank. But don't you come in here and try to make a run on our bank. Don't come in here and try to get your money out because, you know, we need it. We got to use it for stuff. Well, the banks closed on Monday, as we predicted last Sunday, and they have not opened yet. Germany's finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, said Cypriot banks were insolvent if there are no emergency funds, according to a BBS report, meaning savers might lose all their money if no deal was reached. Well, hold on, Wolfgang. That's not your money. That money doesn't belong to the bank. That money belongs to the depositors who had faith in the bank as they earned their paychecks, as they put their extra money away for a rainy day, as they came into Cyprus trusting that Cyprus was a safe place for their money. Everybody's asking the same question here, Wolfgang. Everybody's asking the same question here, Mr. Obama. What's the bank doing with my money? I put my money in the bank to keep my money where I put it so no one would rob me. And the very people that I'm trusting to take care of my money are not taking care of my money. And so we have official suit-wearing, limo-driving, caviar-eating finance ministers saying the bank is insolvent if there are no emergency funds. From where, Mr. Schäuble? From the depositors or from the shareholders of the bank? We think the bank should make it up. Don't you? Well, I think so. Anyway, this whole thing with the banks is so confusing to most people. I want to try to bring some clarity to this. I want to try to let you understand this. But what you're about to hear is a comment from J.P. Morgan's Mr. Bove. Mr. Bove is, he doesn't work for J.P. Morgan anymore, but he is a consultant. He's been around for a long time, and he's well-respected, but he is part of the problem. He's part of the system. He's part of the whole doublespeak that you hear in the news. I don't pretend that you're going to understand all this, but I want you to listen very closely as Mr. Bove tries to paint a picture that what the bank's problem is that they are overcapitalized. They have too much money, and that's why banks go broke. Yeah. Does that make sense to you? Have you ever had too much money and felt like you were going broke? It doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? That's because they're lying. All right, listen closely, Mr. Bove.
If you have the audacity to believe in straight talk, not double talk.
If you have the nerve to believe that in a puzzling financial world, clarity is king.
If you believe nothing beats a sit-down for knowing where you stand.
Join the nearly 7 million investors who think like you do. FaceTime and ThinkTime make a difference.
Join us.
For 90 years, it's how Edward Jones has made sense of investing.
If you have the audacity...
Well, that's not exactly it. That's just the ad. It didn't download. How about that? That's pretty crazy. Mr. Bove tries to make a statement that the banks have too much capital. That the federal government is requiring the banks to keep too much capital on hand, and that's why they're not making money. Well, the truth is, Mr. Bove, that the banks are not meeting the credit needs of the community. And that's why the banks are going broke. Why? Because if you don't meet the credit needs of the community, business cannot grow. If business can't grow, they can't hire people. If people aren't hired, they don't deposit money in the bank. That's how it works. That's how it works. You don't raise taxes. You create more taxpayers, okay? Forget Cyprus just for a minute. It's a much bigger story in the coming weeks and months that will be, not here, in Japan, where one of the greatest economic experiments in the modern era is about to begin. And you're going to hear about it right here on X Squared Radio in about 4 minutes. Don't go away. Relax a little bit. Listen to some Hallelujah by Jody, Alana, and Morgan.
Hallelujah.
Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Thank you so much, Jody, Alana, and Morgan, for that beautiful rendition of Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen's great song. We have been talking about the Cypriot bank seizure, which is a type and a shadow of things to come, not just in the euro, but also in other countries around the world. They're not alone in their problems with the banks. As I told you in the last hour, Cyprus is just a tiny picture. It's a type and a shadow. There's a much bigger story that's about to begin. We broke it to you about a month ago. It's called the currency war. The last time we really had a currency war was in 1931. And the world doesn't remember what that was all about. There are some writers out there that are trying to keep up with what the ramifications of what this might be. What are the causes? How to avoid it? What are the results? Who gets hurt? But there isn't much history out there. The as you know, history is written by the victors. And so the only history we really have has been written by the victors of the last currency war. Now we have instant communication around the planet, not only from Japan outward to other countries, but we also have lots of friends and associates in Japan that are working right now and that communicate with us on a real-time basis. A country where government debt even dwarfs those of Europe's crisis-ridden nations, Japan, will attempt to inflate its way out of a 23-year deflationary spiral. Now, I have some audio on this tonight. I'm trying to see if I could find the link, but I think what happened was I could not download the link. So let me see if I can just paraphrase it for you. Japan entered its recession, its 23-year recession, in probably the best position that anyone could be in. The mighty Toyota, the mighty Honda, the mighty Nissan, Suzuki, Yamaha, other great companies, Sharp, Toshiba, Panasonic, Sony, all were profitable. They had tons of money in the bank. Their debt to GDP ratio was only 25%. The average savings amount for a Japanese citizen was between 10 and 15%. Now, when have you seen that in any nation? Certainly not in this nation in a long time. But 23 years of deflationary spiraling to death can take down any country, and look where Japan is today. They are now 326% in debt to their gross domestic product. Their unemployment is high. Their savings rate is non-existent. People are getting by living in closets, living in small areas, just trying to get by. That's the kind of thing that you won't see after 23 years in this country. That's the kind of thing you'll see after 23 days in this country. GM, Ford, Chrysler, GE, all are having financial troubles. All of them are having troubles. Average savings amount of Americans, not much. 1% to 2%. Most people try to save money, but as soon as they get a little bit of savings, that old car breaks down. One of the kids gets sick. Something breaks in the house or the apartment. They have to move. They lose their job. Lots of unknowns, lots of things making it unpredictable for the average American. We are not in the position China or Japan was in when they entered their recession. We entered the recession in 2008 in just about the worst possible condition. Well, the overwhelming consensus among the world's economists is that quantitative easing, also known as QE, if you hear this on the news, has saved the day in the U.S. and that Japan needs to follow suit. On a larger scale, I beg to differ and suggest this policy, will almost certainly lead to hyperinflationary disaster in Japan. If that's right, it will have serious ramifications for other countries, including this one. One of the things my friends and I used to do very carefully is we would watch the Nikkei. The Nikkei is like the Japanese Dow. And when the Nikkei drops, and we usually see that drop somewhere around 6 in the morning when we wake up and watch the news, we know what the market's going to do in the United States that day. And so if you're a day trader, you can move your money around and you can hedge and you can take care of things because you knew the Nikkei was going to go up or going to go down or whatever. Well, going up for the Nikkei has not been the word of the day for a long, long time. So if that's right, the ramification will spread here, dragged down by an acceleration of the so-called currency wars. More broadly, though, it's likely to destroy the myth pushed by today's economists, and you hear it every day on every business program, that quantitative easing is a cure-all for downtrodden economies. It isn't, and Japan will become the template to prove it. This is the first time that a country has grabbed a hold of its own currency and forcefully deflated it. And it's like a reverse split for a stock company. Let's say a company has 400 billion or 400 million shares on the market and it's selling for 10 cents a share. It's very difficult for them to raise money. It's very difficult for them to have value in the company. Now, the value of the company doesn't change. But what they'll do is they'll do a reverse split. Let's say 4-1. So they go from 400 million to 100 million and the stock goes from 10 cents to 40 cents. Or they do a 100-1 split, and it jumps up to $4. Now you're up on the main Dow. Now you're no longer a penny stock. But the value of the company hasn't really changed. The only thing you've changed is the price per share. Got it? Well, the new Bank of Japan governor, Haruhiko Kuroda, started work on Thursday, and his first day on the job, Friday, disappointed investors. At a press conference, Kuroda pledged to do whatever it takes to defeat deflation and reiterated the country's target of 2% inflation. But he provided little in the way of specifics, and investors promptly bought the yen and sold stocks. One of those investors, George Soros, made $1 billion in 1 month on the yen. More concrete measures will almost certainly come by the central bank meeting on April 3rd and 4th. That's in about a week. There are good odds that they may come even earlier via an emergency meeting of the bank. It is widely expected that the Bank of Japan will expand its 100 trillion yen asset buying program by more than 10 million yen. Also, that's about 10, well, it's just a small amount, but listen, it will start buying Japanese government bonds with remaining maturities of up to 5 years by scrapping the upper limit of 3 years by the end of April. Now, the idea behind the strategy is that you create money out of thin air. Like I said, there's no value. You have not changed the value set. You create money out of nothing, and then you use that money that you created out of nothing to buy government bonds off private institutions and others that own them, thereby increasing money supply and possibly inflation. That's how inflation is created. Governments print money. In other words, an ounce of gold goes from $1,800 to $3,000. Has the gold change in value? No. It's the dollar that changes in value. That's the inflation. Inflation is created by government printing money. It does it several ways, by the way. One, of course, they just run the presses. And the other is that they enforce a minimum wage. They force the wages of the people up. What does that do? It prints money. You're not getting a single ounce more value out of those people. What you have done is you've created value out of nothing. You've made a $10 an hour person worth $15 an hour, so to speak. But he's doing the same work. You're getting paid the same for your product. So what has happened? Your buying power has been reduced. That's inflation. That's quantitative easing. Now, the institutions will start lending the money out, thereby kickstarting spending and the economy. That's the theory, anyhow. What was fascinating to watch was the verbal sparring between the outgoing and incoming Bank of Japan governors. In Japan, where group consensus rules, this was almost an outright brawl. I mean, it was martial arts in suits and ties. Outgoing governor Masaki Shirakawa has never been a believer in the inflationist policies of the new government, and he didn't mince his words in the final days in the office as he squared off against them. He said, even if prices rise 2% and wages do the same, that won't mean an improvement in the people's living standards. What we want to achieve is an increase in real economic growth. Past figures in Japan, as well as in Europe and the U.S., show that the link between the monetary base and the prices has been broken. It doesn't work. The latter refers to the fact that printed money in the U.S. and Europe hasn't flowed through to economies as banks have sat on the money rather than lending it out. Now you see the problem. Yes, they're printing $40 billion a month, $40 to $80 billion a month. But are you seeing it? Are you getting an envelope in the mail? Is your small business getting a shot in the arm? Is your local bank now opening its doors and saying, hey, we're going to make small business loans? I didn't think so. I'm seeing a show of hands that say, no, that's not happening. That's exactly right. That is exactly right. Mr. Shirakawa is exactly saying the truth. They print the money, absolutely, but it doesn't make it to the small business. And if Shirakawa wasn't clear with the above, he was with the following. Here's what he said. If there was one single measure that would have resolved the problem, just like clearing a fog, then we wouldn't have been in this state for the past 15 years. The new Bank of Japan chief, Haruhiko Kuroda, wasted little time trampling on his predecessor's legacy. Though couched in economic jargon, his statements were clear enough. Shirakawa was part of a failed era of central banking, and something new needed to be done. It is very important for the Bank of Japan to make itself responsible for the 2% inflation target by a certain period. We should not make excuses that it wasn't our responsibility if we fail to achieve it. And in the long term, the correlation between money supply and inflation is high. We have seen this in the United States. In other words, if we print money, inflation will come. And we'll do whatever it takes to get the job done. Well, everybody in the world, and now you, because you're listening to this program, are wondering, is this the right path? I mean, think about it, people. Inflation, we have always thought, oh, gee, the economy is growing. Demand is up, therefore prices are going up. Excuse me while I take a sip of my my grapefruit juice. Well, that's simply not true. That's not what makes prices go up. Yes, I mean, the price of a Corvette will go up if it's a special model and there's little supply and lots of demand, it becomes worth more, but it doesn't work that way with money. Money becomes worth less, inflating the amount of dollars it takes to get something done when the government prints money. That's the only thing that creates inflation. Well, inflation is not growth. Inflation does not add value to the economy. It only adds numbers, you know, smoke, mirrors. Now you see it, now you don't. So let's answer the question. The sparring between the two central bankers isn't just an arcane discussion. It's not just two guys in suits and ties, you know, sparring martial arts for the cameras. It's a difference in philosophies. It's a difference in the effectiveness of stimulus policies. And I'm going to tell you right here that we've looked at the mathematics of this. We've looked at the algorithm of this. And we know where the problem is. We know the root cause. But we will not administer the cure. I was speaking to Bill Bennett and Fred Barnes. You know who they are, right? Bill Bennett, former Secretary of Education. Fred Barnes, Fox News contributor, the guy with the glasses, brown framed glasses. Both smart guys. And they asked me, what would you do specifically to kickstart the American economy? And I said, here are two things specifically that you could do. I've discussed this with you before on this program, and I did with them. And there were a few million listeners at the time. And I said, Fred, it's good to hear your voice. And Bill, here's exactly what I would do. Very first thing that I would do is I would remove capital gains taxes on profits made from investments in companies with a market cap of less than $50 million. By most analyses, this is a small business. No, it's not a small business like a one-man pizza store, but it's considered a small business in America, less than $50 million market cap. In other words, it's doing less than $50 million a year in sales. It isn't much. You remove the capital gains tax on the profits made from investments in those companies, and what you will do is you will attract real capital, not government capital, private capital. There's about $5.5 trillion in cash sitting on the sidelines, and it's not in America. Oh, it's American money. It's owned by Americans, but it's not here. It's somewhere else where no one can find it. You're going to attract that money back into the country, into those U.S. companies. Why? Because it won't be taxed. And what will happen is those private investors become the bank. They're the ones meeting the credit needs of the local community. They're the ones putting the cash into these businesses so that they can buy machines. They can buy up these empty plants and warehouses. They can put people to work. They can start making stuff and exporting it and shipping it. And who's going to buy it? Well, the very people that are working at that business will buy it. Why? Because they're going to be working. They're going to have wages and jobs because the marketing plans of the people that own that business, the shareholders and the managers that own that business, that have been screaming at government for 20 years, please provide us a source of capital that we can borrow in order to create these goods. We have good credit. We got great sales. We got a great idea, but you won't loan us the money. And so you attract this capital back into the business. Now, the second part is just as important as the first. And if you don't do it, not only will the money not return, but the small businesses wouldn't benefit from it even if it did. And this is very, very important. You have to stop the naked shorting of those publicly traded stocks. You have to stop the companies that naked short these stocks from trading. In other words, if they fail to deliver a share, they fail to deliver a share, they cannot trade the next business day. You have to enforce that. You have to make it automatic in the system. You can't just go about prosecuting people because it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because the Department of Justice won't bring the cases. There has not been one in more than 52 months, not one case. The naked shorters are running a scam. They are printing shares out of nothing. They're borrowing shares that don't exist. And then they're selling them to you on the public market. And you have no business buying them. You're too stupid to know that the shares don't exist. And when you do buy the shares from Fidelity or Citigroup or MassMutual or Scottrade, they don't deliver the shares to you. You just think the shares are in your account because you look at your online thingy and it says, oh, I have the shares of XYZ company. No, you don't. You just think you do. And then what the market makers are going to do, which work in cahoots with them, is they publish all kinds of bad news, drive the stock price down, and when they do, guess what? They don't have to deliver the shares. And if they're smart enough and successful enough, they drive the business into insolvency and it delists, which means they never have to deliver the shares and they don't have to report the profits. Now, is it legal? No. It is illegal. Are they going to be prosecuted? No. Why? Because those very same firms are the biggest contributors to the president's campaign ever. That's why. Now you know. But you can go around all this by creating an automatic system that if you fail to deliver the shares, you cannot trade the next business day. The naked shorters will dry up like maggots on a sunny sidewalk and they will go away, which means small businesses can raise the money on their own. They don't need the banks, which means you don't need quantitative easing. You have attracted the dancers back to the dance. They're going to start drinking and eating, and everything's going to be great. That's what Japan needs to do. What's amazing is the extent to which those advocating stimulus in the slow growth developed world now dominate the public debate, exactly as I said. Now, consider a recent article by Financial Times columnist Martin Wolf. This article was entitled "The Sad Record of Fiscal Austerity." In it, Wolf takes Europe to task for enforcing the spending cuts, which is austerity, while their economies were in dismal shape. By adopting outright monetary transactions, the European Central Bank, that's the ECB, could have prevented the panic which drove the credits spreads. A credit spread is what attracts investors. It also attracts banks to sell. They make money on the service release premiums and the spreads. It did not do so. Tens of millions of people are suffering unnecessarily. It's tragic. He goes on to recommend a mix of stimulus, increased public spend, and structural reforms to help Europe's plight. And he finishes with this. In the long run, the fiscal deficit must close. In the short run, the UK has the chance to pursue growth. It should take it. So should the US. Now, what will happen is that these two paths will cross. As the economy grows and more people go back to work and thus more taxpayers and more buyers, and the government stops spending so much, those two lines will cross and the budget will balance itself. You don't have to take everything away from the people in order to make up the debt difference for the government. And you don't have to do pure stimulus, shoving everyone back to work and trying to catch up with your spending. You do both. You cut the spending and you increase the growth, and the two lines cross. Fact one, the U.S. recovery proves stimulus works. It does. And the recovery will happen faster if there's more aggressive quantitative easing. That I don't necessarily agree with. Europe remains in the doldrums because it's pursued spending cuts, which has failed to repair the economies. Japan has never tried aggressive stimulus to overcome its long-term deflation problem, and it needs to follow in U.S. footsteps immediately. Well, that's because if they don't, the U.S. is going to go broke. We need more people to follow what we're doing, but what we're doing is wrong. What we need to be doing is cutting back in federal spending and then increasing. And what I mean by cutting back in federal spending, I mean, you know, we could probably cut 8 to 10% out of our budget pretty easily. without affecting the economy. This would affect mostly obscure stuff, entitlement stuff that nobody cares about and doesn't do anything to stimulate the economy. But the more important thing is to change policy to attract investors to put their money alongside the government right back into the economy. The stimulus doesn't need to just come from the government. The stimulus needs to come from the people who have the cash. I'm sure you agree. Now, we don't want the government going in and seizing the depositors' money like they are in Cyprus. That's a bad idea. What we want is for those people that have the money in the bank to remove the money from the bank and put it back into the community, but they're not willing to do that. Because if they take it out of the Bank of Cyprus and they put it back into the community, guess who gets to see it? The government, and they get to tax it. And that's the problem. You have to give this cash the ability to get the seed into the ground, get the seed watered, let the seed germinate, sprout forth, come out, give fruit before you start the taxing. But by then, the economy will have grown to the point where you've caught up with the spending cuts that the government's doing, and everybody will be fine. That's how it has to work. Now, here's exactly why what they're doing will not work. This is why Japan will fail. The subtitle indicates where I stand on the matter. Given its over-indebtedness, and right now Japan is about 245% more in debt. I'm sorry, 326% more in debt than their GDP. It's about 245% higher than any other country. Real world, and I'm talking about a fire sale here, real world, Japan's total debt to their gross domestic product. Now you better sit down. Hold on. Let me take a sip of my grape. Just take a breather. You're getting excited here. Hold on. Okay. The total debt to gross domestic product in Japan is 500%. 500%. Even though Toyota, Honda, Yamaha, Toshiba, Sony, Nissan, I could list company after company after company. They're all profitable. They're all building world-class profits. They're all doing great. Sharp, Samsung, come on, the list goes on and on and on. You know these brands. They're all doing great. Government expenditure to government revenue is a staggering 2,000%. Meanwhile, interest costs on government debt equals 25% of government revenue. There's no way that Japan will ever repay this debt. You understand? It has two main options. Either go through extraordinary pain by cutting back on government expenditure, or print substantial money to inflate some of the debt away. It's the only thing they can do. Now, Japan is going to choose the second option. I can tell you that right now. As are most governments around the world, we're doing the same thing. It would rather print money than cut spending and doom the economy to a substantial contraction. Frankly, after 23 years of deflation, they can't take it. The choice to print money will result in an even more painful and drawn-out outcome, however. Both strategies are going to destroy Japan. It is inevitable that the yen will fall further from here, potentially much further, like 70%. I previously said that the yen at 200 or 300 on the dollar would not be a surprise. When I was in Japan, it was about 10 to the dollar. Yeah, you figure it out. Exactly right. 30 yen for $3. That's about where it used to be. We're talking about 300 yen for a single dollar. This could prove optimistic, by the way. It could be worse than that, especially if investors get involved. And I can tell you right now, cash investors like Soros are going to descend on Japan like vultures. It also seems inevitable that Japanese interest rates will rise and bonds will sell off. That's what happens. When interest rates go up, the bonds sell off. Yields have to rise to just 2% for the interest costs on government debt to take up 80% of the government revenue. The jig will be up well before that happens, though. Those that argue this won't happen, as 91% of Japanese government bonds are held by domestic investors, are missing some key points. Foreign ownership of bonds is rising as domestic investors need more money to fund their retirements because, as you know, Japan is rapidly aging. They have had a one-child policy for a long time, and their median age has been going up by 1 year every year for a long time. Foreigners will demand higher yields for the risks that they're taking on, and even domestic investors aren't going to sit by earning 0.6% on a 10-year bond. It ain't going to happen. So let the currency wars begin. Talk of currency wars has been on the back burner for about a year. Expect that talk to heat up and become a reality as Japan ramps up stimulus in the next 2 weeks. 2 weeks, people, you're going to see it. You're hearing about it first, right here, and unless you read a couple of online news things that I do. Now, that's Japan, a small island about the size of the state of Tennessee with 84 million people living on it. They're great people. They're hardworking people. They're honorable people. They have a great society from top to bottom. I've been there. I love the culture. I love the people. I love their technology, and you do too. You're probably wearing some of it right now on your body. You're probably listening to this program through it right now. But there's much more to it than just Japan, now isn't there? There's the United States, and where is our debt held? Well, Japan used to be a big buyer of it. Let's face it, people, we're talking about China. Now, what is China going to do about Japan? Well, I'm glad you asked that question. China has been less vocal than other emerging market economies in recent months in voicing discontent about developed countries' loose monetary policy. But then China's a little smug about it since they set the value of their own currency. And many politicians have labeled them in the last year as currency manipulators. Look who's calling the kettle black. But as the Japanese yen slumped to the lowest level against the dollar in more than 3 years just this last Thursday, Beijing probably decided that that was just about enough. On Friday, the very next day, China's commerce minister, Cheng Deming, said he's concerned at the risk of competitive devaluations and warned that emerging markets will be the ones left to pay the price for currency wars. And it's true. Speaking at the National People's Congress, China's rubber stamp parliament, I love those business cards, the National Deputy Director of Paper Towels. Wonderful, wonderful titles. Quite the dinners there. Lots of toasting going on with Chinese whiskey. Horrible stuff. If you like Japanese whiskey, you can call in and tell me about it. It's 888-429-5471. Whew, that's why they serve it in those little bitty, like, 1/5 ounce shot glasses. Because that's about all you can get down your throat without losing your dinner. Yeah, it's not like Jack Daniels or Crown Royal. Let's be serious. He said, I'm worried about inflation, competitive currency depreciation, and about the negative spillover effects of excessive issuance of the main currencies, Chen said. responding to a question about the impact of a weakening yen and what it would have on China's foreign trade. Earlier this week, Gao Shiqing, the president of China's giant sovereign wealth fund, warned Japan against using its neighbors as a garbage bin by deliberately devaluing the yen. But that's exactly what they plan on doing. Treating the neighbors as your garbage bin and starting a currency war would not only be dangerous for others, but eventually be bad for yourself, Gao said in a Wall Street Journal interview. I would hope that Japan doesn't do that as a responsible government. Global worries over competitive devaluation have been on the rise since Japan's freshly installed prime minister went into office. The Bank of Japan has agreed to a 2% inflation target and to make open-ended asset purchases from 2014. The hot money, that's what a lot of people want to know. What do we do? Where do we invest? What's happening? Behind the rhetoric of the global currency wars, as we pointed out in earlier shows here at X Squared Radio, lies a more fundamental concern that loose monetary policy in the developed economies will lead to rapid and destabilizing capital inflows to the emerging world. Leaders in the emerging economies, led by Brazil, have long criticized the U.S. for launching successive bond-buying programs to stimulate the American economy since the financial crisis in 2008. Come on, we've been the world leaders at doing this. The tidal wave of Western money, Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff, called it a tsunami of cheap money, not only pumps up asset markets, such as stock and bond exchanges in emerging countries, but it also makes controlling inflation that much more difficult and puts unacceptable upward pressure on emerging market currencies, weakening exports and growth. That's for Brazil. It helps exports for us. For developing countries like Brazil, the result is a dangerous buildup of leverage and finance consumption that ultimately proves to be unstable. Well, yes, it is unstable from their standpoint. But the scandal is much bigger than that, because we're not just talking about the currency. We're not just talking about the pressures that are brought on by manipulating the value of your currencies to save your country from its death spiral. And we're not just talking about Japan. We're also talking about Vietnam, you know, the Vietnamese currency is about to come back onto the market. It's about to be revaluated and come back on the market. The Iraqi dinar is about to be revaluated and come back on the market. These are two big, big emerging markets. Vietnam, as you know, is no longer our enemy. There was a summit that was held there last year in which all the Asian countries, which make up roughly half the world's population, had a financial summit, you know, like the G20 and the G8, as I explained before. Mr. Obama was told to go home. You have no place here. You're not going to be involved in this. This is just the Asian countries. And so he came home, and you didn't hear much news about it. But the scandal goes much further than that. As these two new currencies, not new currencies, but old currencies, which were taken out of the world market because of conflict, are now coming back into the world market. But there are millions of investors in the Vietnamese currency and in the Iraqi dinar, not the least of which is the U.S. Treasury. And when those currencies revalue, and I would venture to say there are a lot of listeners to this program right here, myself not included, by the way, that own those currencies. They've gone to the banks and they have bought Iraqi dinar, real hard cash, and they have bought the Vietnamese currency, and I can't remember what the name is, and I want to call it the Go, but that's not right. If you know what it is, by the way, just text to me really quick on Skype or call me at 888-429-5471. Let me know what it is, because I hate saying, you know that currency over there, that Vietnamese currency. The point is that when those currencies come back on the market and revalue relative to the dollar, those private investors are going to take that currency back to the bank and trade it for dollars. Why is that a big deal? Because these people bought Iraqi dinar at one-tenth of a penny per hundred. In other words, they bought a million dinars for $1,000. A million dinars for $1,000. Now, if those dinars revaluate at somewhere around $2 or $3 per dinar, which is where they were before the war, by the way, then the people that own 3, 4, 5 million dinars are going to be worth $10, $12, $15 million overnight. In other words, they spent $3,000 and they're going to walk away with $9 million. Yeah, that is a good investment. That's the kind of thing that stimulates the economy. That's the kind of thing that currency, not manipulators, but investors look for. And that's what they're looking to do with the Japanese yen. You understand? Why is this scandal so important? Because one of the things that determines how money moves in debt markets is a benchmark. It's called LIBOR. LIBOR is, for all intents and purposes, it's an interest baseline, okay? It's LIBOR plus one, LIBOR plus two, something like that. You know, you normally hear this kind of language if you're borrowing or selling money. Well, Barclays Bank, the UK's second largest bank by assets, paid 9 senior executives, £40.3 million. That's about $61 million in bonuses. Less than a year after the bank was fined for manipulating the benchmark interest rates, this LIBOR that I'm talking about. Ralph Ricci, the head of its investment bank and one of the last members of the former chief executive officer Robert Diamond's management team, was awarded 5.7 million shares valued at £17.6 million, London-based Barclays Bank said Friday in a statement. CEO Anthony Jenkins was given 1.8 million shares valued at £5.9 million. That's a lot of money. That's a bonus that was given to these men after they were busted for LIBOR manipulation. That's right. Barclays was fined £190 million in June for rigging the London interbank offered rate, is cutting 3,700 jobs to reduce annual costs by £1.7 billion this year. Barclays, which was fined £290 million in June, I'm sorry, let me just, the share releases detailed in this announcement included deferred shares awarded from previous year's annual performance bonuses, and in some cases, vesting of historical long-term incentive plans, the bank said in a statement. Barclays has revised its remuneration policy, and all future incentive awards, short and long-term, will be based on the new principles. But these guys that were involved in this LIBOR fixing, they didn't go to jail. They also didn't implicate anybody. In other words, we're going to pay you all that back compensation that we promised you, okay? As long as we come out of this okay. We can afford a certain amount. We'll pay that. They were fined £290 million is a lot of money. And rigging the London interbank offered rate is illegal. Somebody should have gone to jail, but they didn't, which means somebody who knew didn't talk. And those people that knew received their pay. Get it? Now, I want to try to end this hour on a good note because there's a lot of skullduggery going on out there. Most of you are not great, huge investors. You don't really care about what the mega movers of the world are doing, but you should, because your job depends on it. Your home mortgage may depend on it. Your ability to buy that foreclosure next year or this year that you wanted to buy because you've saved up a little bit of money. The ability to take care of your own family, your own neighborhood, your own city, your own state is really, really important. And some of the states are really feeling this from their own voters, from their own constituents, because many of them are smart businessmen, maybe not wealthy, maybe not global, maybe not international, but they're smart. And they talk to the state legislators, which are local guys, because all politics is local, right? And we're not talking about politics. We're talking about government here. We're talking about government. When states collect revenue from their citizens, they want to turn around and offer some kind of benefit to those citizens, like education, like police, like fire, like some kind of protection from what's going on in the world, and a hope of growth, access to capital, access to technology, access to global markets and national markets. That's what states should do, and that's generally what they do. But a lot of times they don't do a very good job. Some states, well, they get in the way. They get in the way. They take too much of the revenue, or they say how the revenue is going to be spent and it doesn't get back down to the communities. We see this in states like Kentucky. Kentucky has what's called the Golden Triangle, which is basically the three large cities in the East. All the money, or 90% of the money in the state of Kentucky, gets used up in those three cities, and the rest of the state pretty much fends for itself. Cities like Bowling Green and Williamsburg and Paducah, they pretty much have to fend for themselves, because Lexington, Louisville, etc., Franklin, they're going to take all the money, and that's just the way it is. So what happens to Kentucky? It doesn't grow. It sits there and does nothing. For 25 years, Kentucky has stagnated. Its population hasn't grown. Its business base hasn't grown. The governor, and a previous governor, by the way, won an absolute lottery by attracting Toyota to come to the state. Other than that, it's a big fat zero. Other states, like just about 100 miles away to the south in Tennessee, Tennessee has seven states that border it. Tennessee has no state income tax. Tennessee is growing like wildfire. Tennessee just attracted Volkswagen to its Chattanooga, city of Chattanooga. And the state is absolutely booming. It has the finest roads in the country. It has the best healthcare plan in the country. It ranks number 7 in K through 12 education. This is a state that is succeeding. It's doing things right. It's got a balanced budget every single year. It has turned around the feds several times as they have tried to invade the state and confiscate assets. No, I forgot to bring you those stories because I think Alex Jones did a better job and it fits his program format a little bit better than mine. But I'm telling you, some states do it right and some states don't. And in the next hour, I want to talk about what's being done to create capital for these small businesses, because these are smart guys. They're looking for capital under every rock, under every leaf, in every cave, and they're finding it. But the location might be where the sewer lets out, and we'll talk to you a little bit about that. You need to know. You need to know, because your job, your future job, your company's expansion, or that company that's thinking about coming into your state and creating jobs depends on it. You need to know. We'll be right back. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you in about 6 minutes.
Never fall away. One of these days.
Back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. X Squared Radio comes to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina. Our AccuWindow forecast is a little chilly tonight, about 39 degrees and rainy. We didn't get any snow, haven't had any snow to speak of this winter. But the Midwest has been getting pounded pretty well, mostly north of central Kentucky, all the way out in Utah. They've been getting pretty regular snow. It is almost April, so this is not out of the ordinary. Many people are calling this the winter that never ends, and I imagine if you get on a plane in New York and you fly to Washington State, most of the country, if not all of it, is going to be white. That in recent years has not been uncommon because of the climate change that we have been experiencing here in the Northern Hemisphere. The Southern Hemisphere has been going through that as well. Snow in places like Johannesburg and Sydney and places like that, but also blistering hot summers. And I made the comment just a few hours ago, you watch, we're going to go from these record snows and blizzards to 100-degree temperatures before you know it. I think we may see our first hundreds before we get out of the month of April, maybe certainly out of the month of May. We have really, really been having some extreme weather back and forth. It's been difficult to deal with. In this part of the country, we use heat pumps. Heat pumps use the difference between the outside temperature and that that can be extracted from different chemistries of Freon to create heat in the wintertime and cold air in the summertime, but we only get about a 40-degree spread. In other words, if it's 90 outside, theoretically you can get 50 on the inside of the building, 50-degree air, which will cool the building down pretty quickly to about 68 degrees, 69 degrees, which is probably past the comfort level for most people. Most people set their summertime air conditioning at about 73, 74 degrees. It's in the realm of a heat pump. In the wintertime, when it's 10 degrees outside, the best you can get is about 50 degrees inside. That's not good enough for most people, so you make up the rest with electric heat or gas heat. Most places that sit at that line, like here we are in the southern part of North Carolina, we use gas heat and electric air conditioning. But south of here, where you're below the ice line significantly, heat pumps work pretty well. That's the investment that most people have made. But now we're seeing such extremes all the way down as far as Mississippi, where we're seeing lots of snow in the wintertime and tremendous heat in the summertime. Heat pumps just don't get it. So it's a huge investment shift for how we manage our energy in this country, because heat pumps can get up to around 12 or 13 SEER ratings. That's the SEER rating. That's an efficiency rating for the use of the energy
exchange from electricity to a thermal transfer, air conditioning and heat packs are not nearly as efficient, although in the United States, natural gas is pretty cheap. In fact, it's really cheap. It's probably the cheapest, cleanest form of heat that we have. Anyway, I was going to talk to you this hour about where this investment money comes from, because it's all part of the money algorithm that makes business go here in the United States. And if you own a small business or you're out of work and you're thinking about starting a small business, this is where your mindset is. This is what you're looking for. My gosh, where are you going to go to find capital? You can't go to venture capitalists because you're not in business yet. If you don't have revenues for 1 or 2 years, a venture capitalist is not going to look at you. You can't go to an angel investor because all he's going to do is buy your business and resell it in a year, and he doesn't care whether you have a job or not. So that's out. You can't go to the banks because, well, the word bank and loan have not been used in the same sentence for 5 years. Let's face it. So what do? Well, you go to friends and family, you raise $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, and you start your business. And you work yourself for $10 a week or $1 a year or whatever it takes. And you live in the plant, and you have a cot and a bottle of aspirin, and you work 120 hours a week. And if you're lucky, and I mean really lucky, you'll win the lottery, and you'll get to stay in business. If not, well, you'll have to find a job. Unfortunately, not many jobs out there. We're still, even though we've added about 1,500 new jobs here in North Carolina, we're still sitting effectively at somewhere around 11.5% unemployment. And if we took in underemployment, those are people that should be working in engineering or should be working in the professions but are having to take something else like a line worker's job or mowing grass or painting houses or fixing cars or something like that, if you take the underemployed, then we're somewhere around 18.5% unemployed, and that's just not the kind of numbers that you need if your state is going to be successful. So where do you find the money? Aha. Well, you find the money at the same place the government finds the money. No. You don't print it. You go to China. There's a program. If you haven't heard it, you're going to. It's called the EB-5, Edward Baker 5 program. The People's Republic of China, also known as Sichuan Automotive Industries Group, is also known as, well, it goes by a lot of names, but it's all the People's Republic of China. Got it? It's one country that the EB-5 practitioners and related EB-5 professionals cannot afford to neglect. The top five countries in 2012 for EB-5 alien entrepreneurs are China, South Korea, Taiwan, Iran, and Venezuela. Those are the top five. Now, Chinese investors account for an overwhelming 70% of the total EB-5 investment, followed by 9% from South Korea, and the rest of the top five each account for less than 3%. So, we're really talking about a Chinese program. I think you agree with me? Yes. Okay, that's good. Let's go on. Despite the recent statement from the USCIS at the May 2012 stakeholders meeting in California that the EB-5 adjudication standards is not country-specific, blah, 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 judging from recent issued requests for evidence, those are called RFEs, the USCIS has constantly questioned the basis of the capital obtained through lawful means for the investors from China. The RFEs show that there is insufficient understanding of Chinese law. The purpose of this article is to provide a few practical guidelines in the areas of Chinese law that have the most impact with the EB-5 practice. Now, let me explain to you what the EB-5 program is. Chinese investors, People's Republic of China, puts up money, lots of money, like billions of dollars. That money can be used by American businesses to expand, to buy buildings, to buy equipment, to set up assembly lines. You know, the kind of stuff American business should be doing.
They should be manufacturing cars. They should be manufacturing televisions. They should be manufacturing printed circuits and all kinds of new technologies, but they can't. Why? Because there's no capital available in the United States. So that capital is coming from China. Why is it coming from China? Because China's buying up our debt, and they're making interest off that debt. That means they're holding onto the instrument, and they're making piles, and I mean mountains of profits off these debts that they buy from the United States. They then turn around and take those very same profits, and they reinvest those profits right back into America. In other words, the taxpayers' money is being taken from your check. The extra debt is being sent to China, which is then providing the money to the U.S. government to run. And then all that money that China makes off it is turning right back around and investing back here in the United States. The very thing that we should be doing with our own money, but we're not. That's what the EB-5 program is. Now, the EB-5 program has some strings attached, and that's why you need to be familiar with Chinese law. Because they're not just loaning the money back to you for you to build your business and make a profit and pay back that loan. Uh-uh. Doesn't work that way. This is all tied into immigration. That's what the EB-5 program is, okay? They work with immigration agencies in China. The immigration agencies have the monopoly in the immigration industry in China. The investors, who often speak little English, if at all, approach the agencies for immigration consultation. In other words, we need to export Chinese workers, okay? We need to find them jobs somewhere else because we have 1.2 billion people and we have no jobs for them. So they export the workers. Now, it's not surprising that some of these are easily defrauded, okay, because they get down and they don't really understand what's going on and they get ripped off by American companies. So because of the language barriers, the clients with the immigration needs are easily defrauded. The immigration agencies, or in Chinese, it's known as Zhangji, suffers a notorious reputation. It is not surprising, therefore, that immigration agencies are heavily regulated in China. The governing administration is the Bureau of Entry and Exit Administration under the Ministry of Public Security, which is right next to the Ministry of Paper Towels. According to the measures on the administration of intermediary activities of exit and entry for private purposes, boy, that's a long agency name. It fills up a business card in Chinese kanji, too, let me tell you. Article 17, the immigration agencies are required to obtain the immigration agency service business license. You got it? You got to have that license. The license is usually valid for 5 years if issued by the provincial level government. The agencies are subject to an annual evaluation by the local public security bureau. That license gives you the authority take the EB-5 money and provide it to American businesses, which will then use it to expand and grow and blah, blah, blah. But there's a catch. You have to hire Chinese nationals. Now, such requests have led to the misconception that the Chinese agents are conducting their own due diligence background searches on the U.S. law firms. That's not true. Public companies are regional centers. That doesn't happen. They rely upon the licensee in the United States to do that. In fact, the agencies requesting such documentation from U.S. attorneys and entities are more likely to utilize such documentation for the purpose of renewing their own business license with the Public Securities Bureau in China rather than due diligence. In other words, it's a pass-through. I can tell you from personal experience that when you issue a document in U.S. legal language – to an agency in China, they don't understand it. Why is that? Because they don't have the basis in American law. China operates on a different system.
They work on a system of relationships. In this country, we work on a system of language. Legal language, and a lot of you don't understand this, and that's fine. I barely understand it, even though I'm in business. Legal language is designed to remove ambiguity. That is to say, the language says what it says and nothing else. It can't be construed to say anything else. But those words, those implications, that tort does not translate into Chinese. In order to have a license successfully renewed, the agents are required to prove the genuineness of the immigration service they provide and that it does have a genuine working relation with foreign immigration attorneys. We are not talking about loans to American businesses. We're talking about investments in American businesses that create jobs for Chinese nationals. Got it? Okay. There are also some Chinese taxes that you have to worry about. There's some corporate law in China that you have to worry about. These RFEs for what are called I-526 petitions issues such as registered capital, sole proprietorship, business bank account versus personal bank accounts are often questioned. This trend shows a lack of understanding of the corporate law in China. The People's Republic of China company law was overhauled in 2005 when the mandatory minimum registered capital amount was significantly reduced to RMB. RMB is the Chinese yuan, 30,000 to US 4688. That means approximately 6 to 1. For limited liability companies in order to encourage entrepreneurs in the startups in the market. Well, that's us. We're the entrepreneurs. This is the startup market. The minimum registered capital is a unique concept under the company law in China. Basically, it is the seed money put down to initiate business operations. The purpose of the registered capital is to protect the interest of shareholders and the company's business partners. Well, we all know that. Seed money is also affectionately called skin in the game. You don't just come up with a great idea, a great business plan, a great website, which you can do in a weekend if you've got the skills. You also have to come up with some cash. You got to go to your friends and neighbors. You got to go to friends and family. You got to go to friends and people you don't know but can get to know. And you got to raise some money. And then you got to show that you have that money in the bank. And that effectively reduces the risk in an investor coming in and standing beside you. Well, these balance sheets can be created out of, well, pretty much nothing. And so they have been defrauded on a very large scale, and that's why these license holders become the funnel through which the money comes. You can't go directly to the EB-5 program in China and do business yourself. No. You got to go through a license holder. A license holder in the U.S. Now, given the fact that the majority of the EB-5 investors are from China, EB-5 practitioners should be familiar with the basic Chinese legal regime in order to better represent the investor's case in front of the USCIS adjudicating officers. As much as USCIS would like to avoid adjudicating based on country-specific standards, sorry to say, it is inevitable that the investors from each foreign country present a certain pattern in the case scenarios. Due diligence, research, and background information about the investor's lawful source of funds is proved to be effective to strengthen the EB-5 petitions. In other words, they go to your bank issues a letter of credit or a statement of funds, proof of funds, that says XYZ company in New Orleans has this amount of money in the bank, and so therefore they qualify for the EB-5 program. The Chinese come in, they put the money in, which can be substantial, $5 million, $10 million, $20 million, enough to get that U.S. company going. But it's not just an investment program. Make no mistake about it. You got to create a seat. You got to create a place for that Chinese national to come work in your company. Most cities in the nation are trying to get involved in this. And this, because you're talking about the headwaters of pretty easy money to get, because the Chinese nationals might come, and then again, they might not, but the money will. And the approval process is pretty regimented. It's, in other words, the process for making it happen has been figured out. And you know how U.S. entrepreneurs are. Well, everybody jumps into the game. Well, the problem with this is you got to be pretty well connected. And that's where the corruption comes in. And that's what I wanted to give you the heads up. If you're in a small business in America, if you're thinking about opening a small business in America, and somebody in the government, somebody in your city or your county or your capital has mentioned to you the EB-5 program, this is what I want you to be aware of. There's a funnel. There's a network. And you should be careful. If you're in the Gulf states, for instance, there are certain regions around the country, and each one of these, quote, licenses is held by a certain group. Who decides what that group is? Who decides who gets to handle that EB-5 money? And we're not talking about millions. We're talking about billions with a B, a lot of money. We're also talking about economic stimulus on a basis that our own federal government cannot do or will not do. The important thing is that the right businesses have to be stimulated, right? And that means that, well, unfortunately, those businesses with the right political affiliation will get the favors. I'm sorry, I said it, and it's out. Now, federally approved to represent all of Louisiana and Mississippi. By the way, it extends to Alabama, South Carolina, and maybe even to North Carolina. Gulf Coast Funds Management, LLC. Remember I told you? Certain companies get the rights to manage this money. They're the licensee. The money that comes in from overseas through the EB-5 program for a business stimulation. Well, they cover the largest geographical area for a regional center in the United States. I thought I would pick the largest one because it's a good example of this connection. It makes my point. I promise you have never heard this before. You're hearing it for the first time ever right here on X Squared Radio. I don't know what's going to happen to us if we say this, but it's true and I can back it up. Gulf Coast Funds Management used a prudent investment approach to provide job creation and opportunities for capital preservation. I'm not making this up. This is straight off their website, okay? Word for word. President and CEO. You want to know, come on, who runs Gulf Coast Funds Management, LLC? Who runs it? It's not publicly traded. It's privately held, LLC, limited liability company, right? Who runs it? Who's in charge? Who is the person that is the license holder, the largest license holder of funneling EB-5 billions from China to small businesses in America? Who runs it? Who is the license holder? Wrong. No, that's not it either. Anthony Rodham. Name sound familiar? No. Ever hear of Hillary Rodham Clinton? That's right. Hillary's brother. Anthony Rodham is a skilled professional in investment management and business administration. Known for his ability to bring people together, Mr. Rodham has been useful in implementing many different business ideas and international ventures. He has spent many years consulting with businessmen from around the world to help ideas materialize into successful enterprises. Mr. Rodham has been involved in political outreach since 1974. When he worked on Bill Clinton's campaign for the House of Representatives. Later, Mr. Rodham worked with former President Bill Clinton on his Arkansas Attorney General campaign, Arkansas gubernatorial campaigns, and presidential campaigns. Subsequently, Mr. Rodham's political organization skills and personable nature were utilized by the Democratic National Committee for coordinating constituency outreach. Mr. Rodham also worked for his sister, Hillary Rodham Clinton, during her Senate and presidential campaigns. Mr. Rodham studied political science at Iowa Wesleyan College and at the University of Arkansas. He currently resides with his wife and three children in Northern Virginia. Just to let you know, the other head of Gulf Coast Management is none other than the former governor of Louisiana. Now, I'm not implying any kind of corruption here, but that's the same governor that was the failed manager of the state during the Katrina debacle that resulted in the mass exodus out of the New Orleans area. An exodus, I might say, that never recovered. That is to say, New Orleans is doing fine, but all those areas that were bulldozed out of the way, they weren't returned to the people that live there. No. Much finer places were built after that, if at all. And most of the people that migrated north up into Hattiesburg, Mississippi, stayed there. Hattiesburg benefited from it greatly because a lot of the people that moved from New Orleans to Hattiesburg stayed. They found jobs, they built homes, and they never went back to New Orleans because there was nothing to go to. So that's the EB-5 program. That's how it works. So you see that the largest manager of Chinese money coming into this country, ostensibly, legally providing jobs for Chinese nationals inside the United States, is very well connected, Mr. Anthony Rodham. It's a pretty big tent, isn't it, people? That's what I thought. Let's do a quick Wars R Us update. I want to make sure that you know the phone lines are open, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. I'm sure I have your dander up by now, but relax. Relax. You don't have to take EB-5 money. And we are putting appropriate pressure, appropriate information into the right hands, the right people in our government, to try to let them know the real way to stimulate the economy in the United States. We can do it from the ground up, and it will happen very, very quickly because there are a lot of smart people, very talented, very smart, very skillful people inside the United States. And guess what they want to do? They want to go to work. That's exactly the kind of energy that we need. And the American people want products. They want the stuff they want. They want electric vehicles. They want more effective and more affordable housing. They want to be able to have access to capital, to be able to do the things that they need to do. No, maybe go buy a car. Only 31% of Americans can qualify to buy a car at a franchise dealership. That's horrible. It needs to be more like 68%. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean, oh, we need to relax the credit requirements? No, that's not what it means. That's not what it means at all. I don't want to extend credit to people who have no ability to pay it back. But there are a lot of people out there that have a lot of history paying their bills on time. And many of them have gotten themselves out of debt a long time ago. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years they've been out of debt. They've done the right thing on a private basis. But if you get out of debt, it ruins your credit. You've already shown the ability to pay your bills back. Nobody has ever taken a bath because you didn't pay your bills. But because the credit reporting bureaus, Equifax, TRW, because they and TransUnion, because they have created an arbitrary and uncontrolled numerical system of ranking you. And that rank, by the way, depends on lots of things. Your marital status, your race, your income, your stability of your income, and the amount of credit that you currently carry. In other words, if you've been a good little steward and you paid all your bills on time and you paid everything off, you don't owe anybody any money, they consider you a risk. They give you a low number. If you come from the wrong neighborhood, or you've been through a divorce, or you've been recently married, they give you a low number. And that means with that low number, regardless of what your credit history says, you can't buy a new car. You can't buy a new car, you can't stimulate the economy with your money. What you have to do, I'm afraid, is go buy a used car. You can't buy a new car. You want a new car? Of course you do. Can you afford a new car? Of course you can. Can you buy one? No, you can't. Because TransUnion, Equifax, and TRW have decided you're not going to buy a car. We're going to give you a low number, like 610 or 595. You should have a 750 or an 800 because you don't have a red mark on your credit anywhere going back 25 years, 10 years, 5 years. But you can't buy a car, not from a franchise. You've got to have at least a 700 to a 750 to be able to buy a car without that number. And where did this number come from? No one knows. How is it calculated? No one knows. I can tell you, as an insider, your race plays a big part in it. If you're not of the right race, you're not going to buy a car. Just a heads up, people. You should find out for yourself. Go try to buy a car. You'll find out. Okay, let's do a quick Wars R Us update. Everyone is now aware that the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, has been instructing a half dozen agencies to use their surplus budgets not to buy paper. No. They're buying weapons, bullets, and personal armor. And the bullets they're buying, well, they're not wad cutters. A wad cutter is a flat-nosed lead bullet that's used for punching holes in paper targets. It's not designed for self-defense. It's designed for shooting paper targets. It's designed to teach you how to be a better shot. It's called a wad cutter. No. They're not using wad cutters. And they're not using the UN Geneva Convention approved full metal jacket bullets. No. They're using hollow point bullets. And they're not using 38s or even 357s. They're using the government approved 40 caliber. That's a big monster bullet, about 260 grain bullet. That's enough to knock a large person on their heels, let me tell you. Even if it doesn't penetrate you, if it's stopped by some kind of armor, you're going to feel like you've been punched in the chest with a baseball bat. Anyway, you are aware that watchdogs have recorded requisitions for more than a billion rounds of this hollow point ammo on the General Services Administration and the Federal Register. These are two areas where federal agencies, everything that they do has to be published before the American people. That's part of our reporting requirements. You are also aware that the agencies have now been instructed to continue those purchases against federal law without public notice of the solicitations. In other words, they're still buying the bullets, but they're not telling us about it. And with the recent changes in the Freedom of Information Act, it is now all but impossible for citizens to request for this information from the government. Of course, if the government refuses to give it, the agency refuses to give it, then you can sue in federal court and a judge will look at the request, look at the evidence, decide whether or not it impacts national security. If it does not, and believe me, that is the only reason they can refuse, then they must give it. And it's quite expensive. It's quite lengthy. It's a pain in the butt. You got to file a lot of forms. You got to have a smart attorney, but you can get the documents. And a lot of watchdog organizations are being successful doing this. But now the laws have changed. Regulations have gone into place that now allow the agency to lie to the federal judge. The agency can lie and say that it affects national security, and so therefore we're not going to tell you. It doesn't matter what the information is. They now have the right to play the card and lie, and the judge can't do anything about it. So it's unlikely that we're going to be able to know exactly how much ammunition the agencies are buying. Why is that important? Well, because you would expect agencies like U.S. Border Patrol or the National Guard or local police stations, you would expect them to have ammunition purchases. But how about the IRS? How about the National Weather Service? How about the U.S. Forestry Service? Would you expect them to have large ammunition purchases? Well, they are. And we really don't know where that ammunition is going. We're just not ready to know. So the idea behind it is some organization in our government, namely the DHS, is a little out of control. The observations are leading to so many conspiracy theories that it's getting unhealthy. I mean, it just is. We can't keep track of it all, and we don't do conspiracy theories here unless we absolutely have the facts. And that is to say, you know, there is a distrust between the people and the DHS, and it's reaching criticality. Now, I used to think the DHS was there to protect the homeland, you know, security. But it has become increasingly clear that we, the people, have become the enemy. The executive branch has seized control of the state's resources, including their tanks, their planes, and their people, and they have wore them out. They have sent them overseas and wore them out. They come home and they feel there is nothing left to do but put a bullet into their own heads. It is now the leading cause of death among National Guardsmen. Nothing in the past 50 years has killed more American soldiers than suicide among citizen soldiers who were conscribed by the president into a series of illegal wars. And now the DHS has raised another army to fight against us. This time they're using the weathermen. They're using the IRS, the TSA, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the U.S. Forest Service by providing them with personal armor, weapons, and 40 caliber hollow point bullets by the billions. Do you really think it is our elected officials who are behind this? You really think that? Let me share with you the following interview. I think you'll find it interesting. Here we go.
I wanted to commend you for being one of the few representatives who actually voted against the NDAA twice. Was that because of the indefinite detention provision?
Yeah, I think something of so constitutionally suspect. But it's one of those things, if you're not absolutely crystal clear on a constitutional issue like that, we shouldn't take those chances. Now, I gather folks on the other side that think they covered that. I just didn't think we did a good enough job. And based on how hard it was for Senator Paul to get an answer out of this administration very clearly, we need to make that absolutely crystal clear that there's constitutional protections in this country.
Do you think there should be legislative work to stop the deposition matrix, Obama's kill list? Do you think that's any way possible?
Well, one of the difficulties I have as a member of Congress is the failure of this administration to actually provide information on what's going on. You know, when we take office, we sign an oath to office. We also sign a little card that says we have access to classified military intelligence. And I'll just tell you, this administration and prior administrations are not very clear and open and transparent with the folks that actually control their budget. Every member of Congress should know the answers to those questions, whether or not they can share them.
My last question is, the Department of Homeland Security recently bought 1.6 billion bullets, 7,000 rifles, and riot gear. Why does Homeland Security need these weapons of war against the people?
They have no answer for that question. They refuse to answer that. I've got a list of questions of various agencies about multiple things. Far from being the most transparent administration in the world, they are the most closed nature, opaque, and they refuse to let us know what's going on there. So I don't have an answer for that. Multiple members of Congress are asking those questions. But it comes down to it. During the budget process, during the appropriations process, are we willing to hold DHS's feet to the fire? We're going to find out. If we get an answer, right, I say we don't fund them until we get an answer.
Yeah, they're complaining about the sequester, but buying $50 million new uniforms is pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, there's plenty of waste going on, plenty of areas they can make those cuts, and obviously those type of things really challenge Americans. They're worried about this administration.
Well, there you have it. That was an interview that was done by one of Alex Jones's reporters. We like Alex. He does a great job. He's one of the better webcast radio programs out there. He's out there on the front lines doing a great job, and he catches most of the spears for our genre, and we applaud him for it. I've been on his program a couple of times talking about scientific issues, but this is something that every organization is concerned about. I have to tell you that this administration, specifically Barack Obama, has been probably one of the best gun salesmen that in the history of the United States. More guns have been sold in the last 4 years than probably in the previous 40 years. It's really, really been great for the gun industry. They're running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, trying to keep up with orders. But here's the bottom line. For me, I don't know if it's the bottom line for you, but I'm going to share with you my thoughts. I, too, have had that urge. Yeah, I've even gone to eBay. I pulled it up. I looked at it. No, I didn't click the buy now button, and I'll tell you why. Because you could buy a gun because you think that you have to defend yourself, and all that's well and good. Those thoughts are fine. But if you buy that gun and you buy the ammunition for it and you load up that magazine and you go knock an aluminum can around the West 40 and you feel empowered by that, you feel like you could defend yourself, you feel like you could deter someone from taking your space. But at the end of the day, when you buy that gun and you're thinking those thoughts, you have to look down that piece of steel at another human being. And it's highly likely that that other human being is going to be an American. Now, they might be a TSA agent. They might be a local cop. They might be a National Guardsman. But they're going to be an American. You're going to look down those steel sights between you and them, and you're going to make a decision. And that decision is going to change you forever. If you pull that trigger, chances are you're going to die. If you don't die and someone else dies, you're going to wish you were dead. I'm saying you don't need that firearm to defend yourself. What you need is a voice, and you need the courage to be able to lay that government subsidy down, and you need to have the courage to recover your republic. It has often been said by much smarter and previous people than me that when the public can vote for themselves a piece of the treasury, it is the end of democracy. Why is that? Because the people will vote their pocketbook before they will vote their morals. Now, it's a sad thing to say, but when more part of the people are on some kind of government subsidy, and I'm not talking about Social Security, that's your money. Come on. Be serious here with me. That's your money. You put it in there over your working career. I'm not talking about that. Don't play that game with me. I'm talking about a government giveaway, something you didn't earn. Something that you have to rely on to get through your week. I'm saying the moral obligation is for you as quickly as possible to get off of that. And I don't mean stop it. I don't mean send it back. That's not what I mean. You want to earn your own way. You want to get your own job. You want to have your own integrity and have command over your own sovereignty. And the only way you can do that is to earn your own money for your own situation. Now, you could say, hey, I can't make ends meet. I've been on both sides of that, my friends. I've had the opulence and I've had the poverty. And in both conditions, I made ends meet. How did I do that? I did without. And I know so many people who say, I am not doing without. I will have, even if my neighbor has to pay for it. That's not American. That's not American. I'm saying the mentality behind what is driving those gun sales is not American. The fact that our government is our enemy now is our own fault. Why is it our own fault? Because we're voting the people into office that are taking it from us. Have some courage. Start voting those people into office that will return the government to a government. And let's get rid of these rulers. They cannot keep themselves in office. Not yet. It ain't going to happen. We can take control. Now, some states are beginning to do that already. Arizona could soon approve gold and silver as legal tender. They just passed, let's see, it's SB 1439. The bill has already won the approval of Arizona State Senate and Arizona House Financial Institutions Committee, which vetoed the legislation out of a, or voted the legislation out of a committee on a 4-2 vote on Monday. The measure now goes to a vote of the Arizona House, where it's expected to pass. The measure also states any coin or bullion that has gold or silver content and is issued by the United States government can be defined as legal tender. However, no one can be compelled to accept coin or bullion containing gold or silver. The measure would also mandate that coin or bullion containing gold or silver issued by the U.S. government cannot be taxed as property, since it is considered money. If the Arizona legislature enacts 1439 and Republican Governor Jan Brewer signs the measure, which she is expected to do, gold and silver would go into effect as legal tender in the state in 2014. However, House Joint Resolution Number 590, which would have established a joint subcommittee to study whether the Commonwealth of Virginia should adopt the rule recognizing gold or silver bullion or gold or silver coin authorized by the U.S. government as legal currency, died in the Virginia General Assembly State Senate last month. Why? In January, the South Dakota legislature rejected House Bill 1100, which would have made U.S. government minted gold and silver coins legal tender that would be used to pay state taxes at their market value. Only state taxes. It died. Meanwhile, Senate Bill 99, Indiana's version of recognizing U.S.-issued gold and silver coin as legal tender, appears to be buried in the Indiana State Senate Committee on Tax and Fiscal Policy. The Missouri approved gold and silver as legal tender. As the Missouri General Assembly pushes toward adjournment, a bill that originally aimed at exempting gold investors from capital gains taxes has now transformed into the Missouri Sound Money Act of 2012, which would make gold and silver legal tender within the state. House Bill 1637 would allow the establishment of sound money depositories that would allow citizens to deposit precious metals and use debit cards to pay bills out of those accounts. The depositors would be regulated by Missouri's Secretary of State. Simple enough. It also directs that
the state to accept the gold and silver coins issued by the U.S. government for payment of debts. However, the measure would not compel any other person to accept gold and silver coins as tender. What they're encouraging you to do is to turn in your gold and your silver at the state depository, which would still belong to you. You would be issued a debit card, and as you spend that money, the gold and silver would be turned over to the state at market value at the time of the purchase. Utah has also done the same thing. The state of Utah has enacted a law in 2011. On March 25, 2011, history was made when Utah Governor Gary Herbert signed into law HB 317, thereby monetizing precious metals in the form of gold and silver American Eagles and United States numismatics. These are rare coins dated from 1792 to 1964 in the state of Utah. I see this expanding. I think it's going to go to, because a lot of these coins have only a certain percentage of silver or a certain percentage of gold. They're mixed with other metals to give them durability. Obviously, you can't have 24 karat gold coins. They'd be so soft that they'd just, bend up and not be usable. So you got to add copper to them. And let's see what this is going to turn. Okay. And so I see gold and silver growing, and it may encompass the bars. If you're going to buy bars, I recommend avoiding the hand-poured bars. The hand-poured bars might not be actually assayed correctly. I would buy them from a reputable mint like Apmex or Engelhard. They're serial numbered. They're 100% pure, 99.999% pure silver. And also the silver eagles. The silver eagles are 31.1 grams silver, and the rest is copper. Hold on one second while I take care of this one caller. Now, we've had wild weather, of course, in the recent years, from Hurricane Sandy and deadly tornado outbreaks to extremes of drought and floods. They can likely be traced in part to climate change. At least we're starting to hear that kind of clear thinking out there. Extreme weather could include more snowstorms and heavy rain events. Global warming is more likely than the storms are more intense. Sandy's transition from a hurricane to a post-tropical cyclone caused some confusion, but it was nevertheless quite devastating on the people of New Jersey. The onslaught of wild weather has battered the USA in recent years. From Hurricane Sandy and deadly tornado outbreaks, droughts, floods. The drought this last summer was horrendous, horrendous. Our crops really, really suffered because of it. Uccellini, in comments to the USA Today editorial board, Uccellini also cited the likely contribution of global warming to the extreme weather. Global warming is making it more likely that the storms are more intense and produce heavier precipitation. This goes right along with Art Bell and Whitley Strieber's book, The Coming Global Superstorm. I highly recommend that you read it. It's the book upon which the movie The Day After Tomorrow was based. The extreme weather, surprisingly, may even include winter storms, which makes people think, what are you talking about, global warming? It fits the pattern, people. We have observed more snowstorms and heavy rain events, and they have been extreme, just like we're going through right now. Others also aren't so sure about attributing recent specific weather events to climate change. They need to get with the program. There's a lot of evidence. It's mounting. We're just about out of time. We got about 3.5 minutes. So I just want to get this last part in here. According to the historical record dating back to 1895, that's a long time to collect data on a human level with real data, not just history books. 2012 was the hottest year this country has ever seen. We thought that global warming stopped in 1998. It didn't. But it is not just that the temperature has risen. from deadly tornadoes to the widespread coastal damage inflicted by Superstorm Sandy. A lot of that is still underwater, by the way, today. We seem to be living through a period of intensified and heightened weather extremes, just like we've been saying on this program for the last 3 years. And like we said in the Ark of Millions of Years series of books, which began coming out in 2004, whether or not these harsh weather events are connected to global warming or are simply the random violence nature visits upon us is one of the central questions that environmental reporter Justin Gillis tackles in his Temperature Rising series for the New York Times. I'm trying to get copies of that so that I can get some of the information out of it, but it is affecting the melting sea ice, and we have seen that not so much that it doesn't freeze back in the wintertime. It's that it thaws greatly in the summertime. As we get less and less sea ice in the summer and more heat absorption in the northern latitudes, what that is going to do to the nearby land ice is it's going to melt it off. It's going to change the salinity and the heat retention of the sea, which is running the risk of gasifying a lot of methane that's now packed on the bottom of the sea floor. If that methane goes gaseous and begins to come through the water, not only will it kill the sea life in that region, but it will increase the greenhouse gas effect to a point that carbon dioxide couldn't even imagine. It's going to happen, but what we want to do is mitigate man's activities so that we don't push it over the edge. If we push it over the edge to the point of no return, well, we might have to be doing something else on this planet besides sustaining human life. Let's get it together, people. Let's figure out how we're going to handle this society, this global society that we have that is petroleum-based. It's time to get smart. Don't forget the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference coming up in October. Click on the link at xsquaredradio.com. Get involved. Donate. Buy your tickets early. Make sure you're going to be there. Help support us. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.